Welcome to another episode of My Weird Prompts, an AI-generated podcast featuring the random prompts of Daniel Rosehill as answered by a revolving cast of friendly AI characters. Join us for deep dives into AI, technology, and whatever other random thing Daniel finds fascinating today. Subscribe on Spotify or your favorite podcatcher. Now, today's episode.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts. Here's Daniel's prompt.
Hey, Herman and Corin, so you might hear in the prompt today a little man making funny sounds besides me. That little man would be Ezra. You're familiar with him. He lives with us in the house. He's a cool guy. And we're just hanging out in bed here, listening to your episodes, having a great time. Ezra says you're doing a great job. Congratulations. Loving to be geeking out on all this stuff with my dad. So thank you, Herman and Corin, for these generations. Okay, today I wanna hit you guys up with another curveball. As you know, we lived through the war with Iran this summer, the 12-day war, and we spent a considerable amount of time in somewhere where we hoped, you know, that we were safe. And you also know that thanks to my long time policy of preparedness that we had internet because I have a travel router and a little kind of battery supply, and during those many hours I was kind of just reading about all sorts of things on the internet. Curiosity is my middle name, you know, and one of the things I was wondering, I'm always intrigued by this. So the Iranians were launching these missiles, these big, we've talked about in another episode about GPS jamming and INS and just kind of how the physics of the Iranian ballistic missiles that were launched at Israel and the physics of Israel's, the challenge they face in intercepting them in outer space and at, you know, a multiple of the speed of a commercial airline is mind-boggling. And it's actually weirdly what inspired me to kind of dive deep into machine learning and AI. I figured if Israel has people who are smart enough to knock a missile out of the sky in with that kind of precision, I can maybe get my hand on the basics. And it was a weird source of inspiration, but it continues to kind of to push me to learn more about this stuff. And what I was wondering really was, when Iran launches missiles, we were kind of getting these kind of early warning messages from the civil defense here. And those kind of came in different, very, very different levels of readiness. Sometimes it would be, you know, 10 minutes, there's a volley of missiles underway. Sometimes it would be 20 minutes, they were giving pre-warnings. And naturally, they're not disclosing the reasons that, you know, they're giving these specific warnings, nor are they disclosing the warnings or specific areas, I guess, based on where they expect there might be a risk of either impact or an interception. So it really begged the question for me, when Israel is sending warnings, you know, presumably that Israel and its allies have some of the best satellite intelligence in the world. But how does that process actually work? Meaning, when Iran launches a ballistic missile in, you know, towards Israel, or anyone launches a ballistic missile, I presume it's from a sort of remote sensing standpoint, it's a pretty conspicuous event. So is it safe to say that Israel, in a case like this, or any modern you know, military fighting an adversary launching something like ballistic missiles, that you might have essentially real-time intelligence that a missile has been launched? And how does that even work? How would, and again, we're talking hypothetically based on what we know about capabilities, how is Israel able to tell that quickly? And when we talk about the kind of warnings that that a very complex process that a military might face in trying to do this very difficult thing during this war, which any military would do, of keeping the population safe without essentially pushing people into mass hysteria and panic in an already immensely stressful situation. So, you know, the communications from the civil defense, as called in Hebrew, Pikud HaOref, the home front command,
was kind of measured, but very direct and very firm. And I think personally, they struck a pretty good balance. But how does that work? Obviously, the military is not going to tell you, you know, all the intelligence at their disposal in the war, but they do need to tell you enough to get you to give you enough time to get to shelter safely. So how does this kind of process work? How might this chain of command and alerting actually work in real time between, you know, the moment that the military detects a launch through to communicating that out through these kind of civilian systems we have here in Israel, like the red alert system, to basically get people to shelter in time for safety and try to keep as many people safe as possible.
Hey everyone, welcome back to my weird prompts. I am Korn, and I am joined as always by my brother.
Herman Poppleberry, at your service. It is good to be back in the studio, Korn.
It really is. And today we have a prompt that hits a little close to home for us. A housemate, Daniel, sent us a recording where he was talking about his experience during the conflicts in 2024, particularly those 12 days when things were very intense here in Jerusalem. He was hanging out with his son, Ezra, listening to our show, and it got him thinking about the sheer technical wizardry behind the sirens and the alerts we all hear.
It is a heavy topic, but scientifically it is one of the most incredible feats of engineering and data processing in existence. Daniel was asking specifically about the process of detecting ballistic missile launches and alerting the public in real time. How does the military see a launch so quickly, and what is the actual chain of command that goes from a satellite in space to a notification on your phone or a siren in your neighborhood?
Right, because when you are sitting in your living room and that alert goes off, you have maybe 2 or 3 minutes at most, sometimes much less depending on where you are. In those seconds, a massive amount of data has to move across the globe. Herman, I know you have been digging into the specifics of the infrared detection systems lately. Where does this whole process actually start?
It starts about 36,000 kilometers above the Earth. Most people think about radar first, but radar has a limitation. It is line of sight. Because the Earth is curved, a ground-based radar cannot see a missile sitting on a launch pad halfway around the world. So the first line of defense is the Space-Based Infrared System, or SBIRS. This is a constellation of satellites in geostationary orbit and highly elliptical orbit.
And these are looking for heat, right? Not just a visual picture.
Exactly. They use highly sensitive infrared sensors. When a ballistic missile launches, its rocket motor produces an incredibly hot, bright plume of exhaust. This plume is so distinct against the cold background of the Earth or the atmosphere that the satellites can pick it up almost instantly. We are talking about seconds after ignition. The satellite sees this bloom of heat and immediately flags it as a potential launch.
Okay, so the satellite sees a hotspot, but surely there are a lot of hotspots on Earth. How does the system distinguish between a space agency launching a weather satellite, a massive forest fire, or a tactical ballistic missile?
That is where the processing power comes in. The system analyzes the intensity of the heat, the spectral signature, and most importantly, the trajectory. A ballistic missile has a very specific acceleration profile. It is not just up. It is up and over. The SBIRS satellites are constantly feeding data to ground stations like the ones at Buckley Space Force Base in Colorado. They use algorithms to compare the heat signature against a massive database of known rocket engines. Within seconds, the system can say, that is not is not a yes!
So we have detected it in space, but at that point, we only know it is in the air. We do not necessarily know exactly where it is going to land yet, do we?
Not with perfect precision, no. Infrared tells you where the heat is, but as the missile burns out and enters its mid-course phase, it gets colder and harder for satellites to track precisely. That is when the handoff happens. The space-based data is sent to ground-based and sea-based radar systems. For example, the United States and its allies use the ANTPY-2 radar, which is a massive transportable X-band radar. There is actually one of these stationed here in Ezreal Enverreal. There is NASA ActuWeep.
I remember reading about those. They're incredibly powerful. I think they can see a baseball-sized object from hundreds of miles away, right?
Even further. These radars are phased arrays, meaning they do not have to physically rotate to see different areas. They steer their beams electronically. Once the satellite gives the radar a cue, basically telling it where to look, the radar locks onto the missile. This is where the math gets intense. The radar tracks the missile's velocity, its angle, and its arc. By calculating the parabolic trajectory, the computers can predict the impact point within a few square kilometers. So, Hun the Transcribe.
This is the part that always fascinates me. You have this object traveling at several kilometers per second Mach 5, Mach 10, or even faster, and we are calculating its destination in real time. But before we get into how that information reaches the public, let's take a quick break for our sponsors.
Are you worried about the future? Of course you are. The world is full of things falling from the sky, but why let a letter all at your NUDAP? Introducing the Poppleberry Lead-Lined Snuggie. It is the only wearable blanket made from a proprietary blend of wool and recycled dental x-ray aprons. It is heavy. It is the only wearable blanket made from a proprietary blend of wool and recycled dental x-ray. Apery. It's soaked. Perfect for sitting in your basement and kinetic impact, but boy do dad gek.
I really need to talk to Larry about using my last name for his products. I'm pretty sure lead-lined blankets are a health hazard, Corn.
It is definitely sketchy, Herman. Anyway, back to the science. We are at the point where the radar has locked on and the computers have calculated the predicted impact zone. Now, this is where the military to civilian handoff happens. In Israel, this is managed by the Home Front Command, or Pikud Hof. How does that command chain work? Is there a guy sitting at a desk who has to press a button every time a missile is detected?
In the early days, there was more human intervention. But today, it is almost entirely automated because the timelines are so short. When the radar system, whether it is the Green Pine radar used by the Aero system or the radar for the Iron Dome, determines that a missile is headed toward a populated polygon, it triggers an alert. The country is divided into hundreds of these polygons or zones.
So they do not just wake up the whole country if a missile is only heading for one specific city?
Exactly. That is a huge part of preventing mass panic and alert fatigue. If the system determines the missile will land in zone 12004, it only triggers the sirens and phone alerts for that specific zone. The data moves from the military radar through a secure server and out to three main channels: the physical sirens on the streets, the television and radio stations, and the cellular network.
The cellular part is what Daniel mentioned, getting that notification on your phone. I have always wondered why those notifications sometimes arrive before the siren even starts.
That is because of a technology called cell broadcast. It is different from a standard text message. If the government tries to send a million text messages at once, the network will clog up and fail. But cell broadcast is a one-to-many technology. It broadcasts a signal to every cell tower in a specific area, and those towers push the alert to every phone connected to them simultaneously. It bypasses the normal congestion of the network.
That is why the alert sound on the phone is so distinctive and loud, even if your phone is on silent. It is a specific protocol built into the hardware of almost every modern smartphone.
Precisely. In the United States, this is known as the Wireless Emergency Alert System, or WEA. In Israel, it is integrated directly into the Home Front Command app and the local carrier networks. The latency, the delay, is often less than 2 seconds from the moment the computer decides an alert is necessary to the moment your phone vibrates.
2 seconds. That is incredible when you think about the distance the data has to travel. But let's talk about the human in the loop for a second. Even with all this automation, there must be a command structure overseeing this. Who is actually in charge during a barrage?
There is a centralized command center. They are watching the air picture in real time. While the initial alerts are automated to save lives, the military officers have the ability to override or extend alerts if they see a multi-wave attack. They are also the ones coordinating the active defense, the interceptors. So, while the radar is telling the public to run for cover, it is also talking to a battery of Tamir interceptors, or aero missiles, telling them exactly when to meet the threat in the sky.
One thing people often get wrong, and I have seen this in movies, is the idea that the red alert stays on until the danger is over. But in reality, the sirens usually stop after a minute or so. Why is that?
The siren is a go-to-shelter signal. Once the siren ends, it does not mean the danger has passed. It means the calculated time of impact has arrived. The Homefront Command usually tells people to stay in the shelter for 10 minutes after the siren. This is because of the second-order effects you mentioned earlier. Even if an interceptor hits the missile, there is still falling debris. Shrapnel from a successful interception can be just as deadly as the missile itself if you are standing out in the open watching the fireworks.
That is a great point. I think there is a misconception that intercepted means disappeared. It really just means broken into smaller, non-explosive pieces that are still falling at terminal velocity.
Exactly. And speaking of misconceptions, another big one is that these systems are infallible. They are highly accurate, but things like clutterbirds, weather patterns, or even intentional decoys can complicate the picture. This is why the military uses multiple layers of sensors. If the space-based infrared sees it, and the ground-based radar sees it, and the sea-based radar confirms it, the confidence level goes to 99%.
What about the newer threats, like hypersonic glide vehicles? I have been reading that these are much harder to detect, because they do not follow a predictable parabolic arc. They can maneuver within the atmosphere. Does that break the current system?
It definitely challenges it. Because hypersonics fly lower than traditional ballistic missiles, they stay under the radar horizon for longer. And because they maneuver, you cannot just calculate an impact point and walk away. You have to track them constantly. This is why the United States is currently working on the Hypersonic and Ballistic Tracking Space Sensor Constellation. They need satellites in low Earth orbit much closer to the ground than SBR Earth to keep a continuous canonmonic key.
So the weird prompt here really is, we have turned the entire planet and the space around it into a giant multi-layered sensor. We are basically living inside a giant machine designed to detect the heat of a single engine ignition thousands of miles away.
It is the ultimate Internet of Things application, but with much higher stakes than a smart toaster. Every sensor, from a satellite in a high orbit to the GPS in your phone, is part of this massive interconnected web.
I want to go back to something Daniel mentioned in his audio. He talked about the measured but firm tone of the Homefront Command. There is a psychological element to this too, right? How they communicate this to a population that is already stressed.
Absolutely. The design of the alert matters. In the past, sirens were just one long, terrifying wail. Now, the alerts are often accompanied by voice instructions or specific tones that indicate the level of urgency. They have spent years studying how to give people enough information to act without causing a stampede. Specificity is the enemy of panic. If you tell someone the whole country is under attack, they freeze. If you tell them your neighborhood has 90 seconds to reach shelter, they move.
That is the actionable intelligence aspect. It is not just data, it is a directive. So, if we were to summarize the chain for Daniel and Ezra, step one is the infrared blink from a satellite 36,000 kilometers up. Step two is the cueing of ground-based radars to lock onto the object. Step three is the computer modeling the trajectory to find the specific impact zone. Step 4 is the automated push to the tel broadcast network and the physical sirens. And all of the tasks,
usually in under 60 seconds for the whole chain to complete. It is a miracle of modern physics and software engineering.
It really is. So, Herman, what are the practical takeaways for our listeners? Obviously, we hope they never have to rely on these systems, but understanding them changes how you interact with them.
My first takeaway is, trust the Polygon. If your phone goes off but your neighbor's does not, it is not a glitch. The system is being precise to keep the rest of the economy and society moving. My second takeaway is to respect the 10-minute rule. The interception is just the beginning of the physics event. The debris has to land somewhere.
And mine would be to appreciate the human in the loop. Even when things are automated, there are people in bunkers right now whose entire job is to watch those infrared feeds so that we do not have to. It is a massive global effort of cooperation between different military branches and civilian agencies.
And maybe don't buy Larry's Lee-lined blankets.
Definitely don't do that. Well, this has been a deep dive into a topic that is very real for us here. Daniel, thanks for sending that in. It was great to hear Ezra's voice in the background, too. It reminds us why these systems are so important. They are built to protect the people we share our homes with.
Exactly. It is easy to get lost in the cruelness of the satellites and the radars, but the end goal is always human safety.
This has been my Weird Prompts. If you have a question about the technology behind your daily life, or something weird you have noticed in the world, send it our way. You can find us on Spotify and at our website, myweirdprompts.com. We have an RSS feed there and a contact form if you want to be the next Daniel.
Thanks for joining us, everyone. Stay safe, stay curious, and keep those prompts coming.
We will see you next time. Goodbye.
Bye.
This episode was generated using Gemini Flash 3. Text-to-speech engine was Chatterbox Turbo.
Thanks for listening to another episode of My Weird Prompts, an AI-generated podcast featuring Daniel Rosehill's AI prompts, as answered by a revolving cast of friendly AI characters including me, Cornelius the Sloth. Subscribe on Spotify or visit myweirdprompts.com.